Members, we're going to bring the House Environment, Energy, Natural Resources Committee to order. Just a roadmap here, members. We are on a schedule that doesn't allow us to meet tomorrow and Thursday. Representative Hackbart's got additional stops in this bill. We need to move it today. If we don't get done by 10 o'clock today, we will be coming back tonight after Ways and Means. So I would tell you folks that we want to get done today. We want to get this done before 10 o'clock. So just be cognizant of that as you have discussions, because for a lot of people, they're going to be done earlier today maybe and have stuff going on in their district or whatever. But we have to do this tonight. We are not going to wait till next week. Representative Hackbart's got additional stops. There's no reason why we can't get through this. We've got, I don't know if there's a half a dozen total amendments. We have to hear yet from DNR, specifically the fisheries people have not talked yet. There's a few constituents on the list, a few citizens. We're going to give you 2 minutes, and if you waste your 2 minutes by talking about something that's already been talked about, I'm going to bang the gavel and you're going to be asked to leave the testifying. So when you come up, you've got 2 minutes to testify. You need to respect our process. We have had a number of days of hearings on game and fish already, early in session last time, and Representative Hackbart's got a number of stops, and we have deadlines to meet. So, Representative Hackbart, do your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I think we've talked about what's in the bill, and we can get right into some of the other amendments, I would imagine. Mr. Chairman, I think I have the non-controversial 0245. This is the escape of non-native and invasive species, and it has to do with release of swine into the wild. This is some language that I worked out with the department.
Representative Hackbart, I think we have it as the 257. You may be looking at an earlier draft, but we have an A11 dash.
That's correct. I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. That's correct.
Any discussion to that amendment that deals with the feral pig, if I'm not mistaken, issue that you've been the DNR is okay with? Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hackbarth, my question is on line 1.15, the word deliberately, and whether what is deliberately? I mean, if somebody leaves the gate open accidentally and the hog gets out, what?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, that was my concern, and that's why we came up with this language. I don't want that to be the issue, and this is what DNR tells me takes care of that problem, that farmers' hogs get out or whatever. That's not going to be the issue with this language.
Additional discussion. All those in favor of the 257, I'm sorry, Representative Fabian, were you raising your hand? Okay. All those in favor of the 257 say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, nay. Amendments on. Representative Hackbart, or I don't see Representative Dillon here. I thought there was a couple other non-controversial. Why don't we move those, and then when we get into ones that may be considered controversial, if we need the DNR to come down at that time, we will. Representative Hackbart. Or Ms. Rudolph. The 252, Representative Hackbart, that's your amendment? Yep. Representative Hackbart.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that amendment. That's a technical amendment, just a technical change that the DNR needs to put in the bill. It's just an error in the bill.
Questions to the 252? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Amendments adopted. Representative Hackbart.
The next amendment is the, I believe it's the Purple Heart. 253.
Representative Hackbart to the 253.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't have that particular one in front of me, and I apologize for that.
It's okay. Ben, can you get a copy of the 253 for Representative Hackbart? Thank you.
This was, I believe it's the amendment that was in the Veterans Affairs Committee, and this just extends preferences and drawings to Purple Heart and people with 100% disability in the drawings that we have at the DNR for preference.
And Representative Hackbart, I understand it really is narrowed down to just a few individuals.
Right,
and the
it's
DNR
not very many
is okay
people.
With this amendment. I'm looking for, I see the game and fish people nodding yes. discussion. I know Representative O'Driscoll, and I know he's been in contact with my seatmate, Representative Kriesel, about this amendment. Further discussion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Amendment's adopted.
Okay.
Don't we have a Representative Dill amendment at 262? Representative Dill, to your 262.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And this amendment, like I move the amendment first, the 262 amendment. And this amendment is about the using of bait that has been eliminated in previous legislation. It eliminated the ability for, I'm going to give the example that's used at home, is Cisco's, which are very commonly used for trout fishing. So we have a lot of beautiful lakes that are not infected with anything except love for the waters. And right now, they can't be caught. For example, I'll give you a real-life example. Up in Ely and Grand Marais and Finland and places like that where lake trout fishing is big time in the winter, Cisco's are in high demand for bait. Cisco is a big minnow. And, yeah, I'm not sure. Is that a member of the herring family or what? Yeah, a member of the herring family. And they catch them in Lake Superior, and they can use them in Lake Superior. But if they catch them other places, they aren't able to use them, as I understand it. So this bill allows for a water body to be tested and determined to be VHS-free, and for someone to apply for a license or a certificate so that then they can catch the bait in that uninfected water. This is mainly going to be done in Basswood Lake in the Boundary Waters. That's where it's been done for decades and decades and decades to get these Ciscos. And then it prescribes the proper labeling. The person who holds the ability to have that, how it has to be packaged, how it has to be identified, and so that it can have a chain of custody, essentially. And that person will be able then to retail them through other smaller bait shops that would have a need for them. This is something that we've been working on since the previous VHS regarding Cisco's and other types of bait caused this problem. And so really it talks about transportation and reporting requirements and things like that, and the department and Representative Hackbarth and I have been working on this along with constituents up at home that do this trapping and do this retailing. It's very important because it really just about eliminates lake trout fishing up in the northeastern part of Minnesota, because this is just how it's been done forever. A Cisco on a big jig head, they drop it down and jig for the trout, and that's just the way it's done. So I stand for questions.
Questions for Representative Dill to the 262. And Representative Dill, the DNR is fine with the amendment?
Yep. They draft, Mr. Chairman, they have drafted in consultation with Representative Hackbarth, myself, and the constituents this language.
Okay. Sounds good. Questions? All those in favor of the 262 say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Amendment's adopted.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Hackbarth.
There's another technical amendment I think Representative Hansen has that he'd like to change some things on page 11, section 26. Just some technical changes, a couple of comments.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think it's on 11.6. There's a couple commas that are needed. If you read that sentence, it doesn't quite make sense. So I think it's on 11.6, rules setting turkey seasons, comma. And then I think there's a comma that's needed after on line 11.5 on between include and in. So include, comma, in rules setting turkey seasons, comma, the methods for issuing licenses for those seasons.
Ms. Taylor.
Mr. Chair and members, the amendment would read on line 11.5 after include, insert a comma, and then on 11.6 after seasons, insert a comma.
Question. All those in favor of the Hansen oral amendment say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Amendment's adopted. Representative Hackbarth, why don't we have the DNR come down now, fisheries folks? I know Representative Hackbarth got an amendment dealing with that. Mr. Bogus, and if you could come forward and testimony in regards to two-line fishing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Ed Bogus, DNR Division of Fish and Wildlife. We appreciate the opportunity when these, there are several fisheries provisions in the bill that committee heard earlier as separate bills, and the department didn't get a chance to testify except for a couple minutes at that time, so we appreciate the chair allowing us the opportunity right now. And the sections specifically that we'd like to talk about are 50, 55, and 61, and those relate to the experimental and special management waters, the two-line issue, and to the Cass Lake spearing issue. So with that, I'd ask Mr. Dirk Peterson, our fisheries chief, to provide the committee a little bit more background on those issues and some of the concerns the department has on those issues.
Good morning, Mr.
Please introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, my name is Dirk Peterson. I'm fisheries chief for Minnesota DNR. And the first one, I believe, on that list is in regards to the 60 lakes. Is that the first thing? Okay. One thing, hopefully there's a handout that each of the members have that talks about fishing it's the one for the changing the number of lakes with Northern Pike Special Regulations to 60. And if you look on the back of that sheet at the top, there's a graphic that shows a decline post-World War II of the average size of Northern Pike in Minnesota. That is reflective of fishing for Northern Pike and increasing in pressure. And that we're all familiar that by 1990 or so, the quality of fishing in Minnesota had declined. We formed the Fishing Roundtable to address some of those concerns. And one of the things that we did was to start implementing special regulations to improve quality on some waters. And we applied that knowledge to fishing for Northern Pike as well. And we came up with some tools, mostly protected slot limits, to address that. We did our experimentation in the 1990s, refined our tools, and applied them more broadly 2000 and forward. At the time we applied them more broadly, we had about 32 experimental lakes. We sought broad interest from the public on improving Northern Pike fishing, and we had about 75 lakes with associations and sportsmen's clubs that we addressed. And about 66 of those went through a statutorily mandated public hearing process. That brought us up to about 98 lakes. And since then, we've had a few more lakes come in where groups have approached us, or we've talked with groups on improving Northern Pike fishing. From 2006 to 2008, we did a large public review process to establish a long-range plan for muskie and large northern pike, and we put a self-imposed cap on ourselves of about 125 of these sorts of waters. Currently, about 115 waters have protected slots to improve the quality of northern pike, and these regulations, based on our early assessments, are working quite well in most cases. We have dropped 12 lakes over time where we found that they didn't work. The point being is that this is a reasonable number of lakes to have this sort of regulation. It's about 115 waters out of 3,300 waters that have northern pike in them. So that we would like to maintain our current array of waters that provide quality northern pike fishing, and that removing it to 60 lakes, there is no fair or reasonable way to drop that number or cut it in half. These are conversations we've had with sportsmen's clubs, local units of government, as well as lake associations on determining whether they're interested in seeing to have northern pike populations and fishing improve. And then it goes through a mandated public hearing process, and ultimately they're adopted. So choosing which lakes would not be able to continue to go forward in their evaluation and which ones would be a very difficult, if not impossible, situation, and it would probably result in a number of unhappy citizens across the state. Thank you. I can take some questions if you will.
Questions in regard to this part of your presentation. Would you please continue, and why don't you give the rest of the presentation on both the other issues, and we'll see if any members got questions. Then we're going to do Representative Hackbart's amendment, and then we'll have discussion to the whole bill.
Okay.
Continue.
I would like to speak to two lines as it was originally proposed, where we would allow two-line fishing during open water fishing. As many of you probably already know, we already have two-line fishing through the ice and two-line fishing on border waters like Lake Superior, Lake Pepin, and Big Stone Lake on the South Dakota border. Once again, if you have a graphic handout on two lines, if you look at the back, we have a, another excerpt from that study that showed the average size of fish post-World War II steadily declined, competitive size fish steadily declined as angling pressure increased. And that's the result of a one-line fishery. If you were to increase, and so once again, by the time we got to about 1990, statewide, there was a lot of concern that we had become a state of potato chips and quarter pounders, and we instituted the fishing roundtable to try and correct some of those issues. There are two examples below the graphic that show the increase in your chance of catching a fish greater than 19 inches on Lake Winnipegosish with special regulations. That's about a six-fold increase. And also we put a protected slot on the Mississippi River below the St. Cloud Dam to improve the overall fishing for smallmouth. The abundance of larger fish has increased by fourfold. So our use of modern special regulations has been able to restore the quality that was lost on a number of waters around the state. By increasing the number of lines that you can use, when you look at walleye fisheries, our measurements on Big Stone Lake and Lake Pepin indicate that you would have an increase. People, about 30% of the people will use two lines, and that increase in fishing and the amount of harvest of walleye that would occur based on those two data sets would indicate that to compensate for that, we'd probably have to lower the bag limit for walleye to two statewide to compensate for that increased harvest. Now, what I'd like to point out is that fishing in Minnesota is a system, and it's governed by the season, by the amount of gear, the methods that you might use, and the type of bait. All those things come into play, and when you adjust one thing, like the amount of gear going from one line to two lines, you have to consider adjusting the other parts of that system of fishing. Bag limits is one of those adjustments that could be made to maintain the current level of quality that we have. And some of the quality that we have is because of our use of regulations. So where would we see some of the problems with two lines? Something like a very managed fishery like Mille Lacs or Red Lake, where we have a shared harvest. Increases in harvest there could result in a more restrictive regulation. It could also result in some sort of mid-season correction that would occur more frequently, and that could be disruptive to the local economy around Mille Lacs. At the same time, when you're using two lines, the chance of increasing hooking mortality goes up, and this could be most problematic in some of our prized trophy species or large fish like muskie or large northern pike. So those are some of the concerns that we have if you change the amount of gear that you can use. I would like to repeat, fish management is a system, and when you adjust one part of the system, you have to consider adjustment of the other parts. Representative, or Mr. Chairman, I could continue with the third part if you wish.
Go ahead at this point. Go ahead.
Okay. The final bill, or part of the bill that we have some concerns about, is lifting the spearing ban on Cass Lake. Spearing bans have been a way of limiting some of the mortality on muskies. Much like the statewide fishing decline and the northern pike decline you've already seen on your handouts, the same thing happened to muskies post-World War II. The average size of those fish went down. There were problems. And so we tried to correct and restore some of the quality of muskie fishing in Minnesota. One of the tools was spearing bans. That was applied to Cass Lake in 1988, and the test for the statute was that we would demonstrate a relative improvement in the overall size of the muskie fishery. Our surveys over time have indicated that that's taken place. We also think the improvement in the size of muskie on Cass Lake is also related to increasing catch and release ethic. and it's also related to increasing minimum size limits that the department has done over time. We recognize that we've met that standard, but there are other concerns, and primarily it's around Northern Pike. The graphic at the bottom of the page regarding Cass Lake shows the overall increase in the fishing pressure for muskie and northern pike on Cass Lake. And it's quadrupled for northern pike, and it's doubled for muskie. A lot of people are seeking those two species. But the interesting thing with northern pike is that the average size has remained constant, which means that there is a increase in catch and release ethic related to northern pike as well. It's a quality fishery. If the ban is removed, there will be an impact to northern pike. If you look at the backside with the two graphics, the one at the top shows the general increase in the muskie population. The one below shows the average size of northern pike in Winnebogoshish as well as Leech Lake, which allows spearing, and Cass, which does not. And the average overall size of northern pike and Cass is considerably larger. The committee may wish to consider that a protected slot, like a 24 to 36 inch protected slot like we use on a number of our northern pike special regulation lakes, would be a tool that would maintain the current size structure for northern pike if the ban were lifted.
Questions for the DNR at this time? Representative Hackbart, why don't we do your 271 amendment. Representative Hackbart, I believe it replaces the 077. If some folks have, remember we originally thought we were going to do some of these amendments last time. The 077, Representative Hackbart, maybe you could speak to the difference in what was involved. Representative Hackbart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The original amendment was drafted incorrectly, and it took two-lane fishing away from ice fishing. So we redrafted it just to correct that error. And what this now does is make it makes two lines available for just about anything except trolling. You can fish two lines from shore, from a dock, pier, or from an anchored boat or an anchored watercraft, but you cannot troll with two lines. That was a concern that was brought to me by a number of people, resort owners, etc.
Representative Deal.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I also think that I'm trying to figure all this out now, so give me some latitude. It also eliminates the way that I fish is by jigging, and I'm supporting that. It also eliminates, you know, using a jig or drifting or using a motor to back troll, and you wouldn't be able to have two lines under any of those circumstances as well. In that instance, to have two lines under this amendment, you'd have to be anchored, at anchor, correct?
Representative Hackbart.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Deal, that's correct.
Representative Deal.
Well, Mr. Chairman, editorializing on that, I think there's a huge amount of fishing that's being done by drifting and by back trolling in Minnesota. I mean, there's boats specifically for back trolling. There's things that are developed specifically for drifting to get the speed down so that you don't go like crazy on a windy day. So I think that would have a huge impact on how this bill would play out in the future.
Thank you. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just like to hear the DNR's reaction to this fairly new proposal regarding two-line fishing.
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, I would like to go back to the comment that we have a system in fishing that's fundamentally been based on one line since 1920, and our adjustments around bag limits and length limits and other tools that will be used has been adjusted around one-line fishing. And I commented on what two lines probably would do statewide. This is an intermediate proposal, which we don't have specific data to estimate what that would do in regards to bag limits or whatever. But I would suggest that on a fishery like Mille Lacs, where there's a lot of slip bobber fishing, you will have an increased walleye harvest and mortality there, and hooking mortality that will certainly cause some of the concerns that we raised previously about just having two lines in general on Mille Lacs.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned a couple lakes earlier where we do have two-line fishing in Minnesota waters today. This amendment, I guess, would somewhat restrict that fishing that goes on in those waters. Would that counterbalance this at all, or don't you have any reaction to that?
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, if I understand your question correctly, would this affect border waters?
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chairman, no, it would maintain the two-line fishing that occurs on Lake Pepin and Big Stone Lake, as well as on the waters of Lake Superior, which I believe the amendment doesn't address.
Additional questions for the DNR? Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. To the DNR, if this amendment were to pass, would you study this for a while, or would you automatically adjust your limits for walleye?
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, I don't have, you know, we have angler data from a number of sites. We have not analyzed the data in reference to this bill. We would have to look at that information and make some judgments about whether bag limit adjustments would be necessary on our important waters of the state like Mille Lacs or Red Lake. But we could certainly anticipate that there would be an impact and that we would have to make a recommendation to the public in those regards.
Representative Anderson.
Yeah, just one follow-up, Mr. Chairman. I understand Wisconsin does have two-line fishing. How do our regulations in terms of limits compare to Wisconsin?
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, I'm not an expert on Wisconsin fishing regulations, but I can certainly highlight that trolling is not allowed, and that's one way to minimize angling mortality. Their bag limits are different, and their whole system of fish management is kind of built around two lines with trolling restrictions and other features, like I think their walleye bag limit is 5. You know, so there's a number of features that they've played through over the years. Our system with one line and some of our protected slots and our current bag limits is a system that's evolved over decades here in Minnesota. I would caution the committee to consider altering that.
Representative Dill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And back to Representative Torkelson's question, I don't really think we got to the end of the road on that question. I think the question was, is that right now two-line fishing is done any way you want on Lake Pepin, standing on your head or otherwise. And so now this amendment, if it were to pass, would say that you'd have to fish from shore or a pier or from an anchored boat. And so I think Representative Torkelson's question was, is how is that going to affect lakes like Lake Pepin, where they already have two lines? Just just looking at that, I think that it would have a significant effect on the fishery there if in fact it does have an effect at all by reducing the harvest in those lakes, because you're now limiting the way that you can fish. That's my first question.
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dill, what we strive to do on border waters is have consistent regulations between the states and the provinces. And so to that end, we would strive toward that and probably continue to allow trolling or whatever Wisconsin is allowing at this time, what is currently out there, to continue.
Mr. Boggs.
Mr. Chair, if I could just kind of jump in here. I think Representative Torkelson's and Dill's questions are, if this were to pass, would we be able to allow those consistent regulations between the states? And the way I'm reading it, we would not. We would still be restricted by state law for our side of the border waters. And I think the other issue that Mr. Peterson mentioned is that currently Lake Superior allows, we allow two lines on Lake Superior, on the Minnesota side of Lake Superior, and this amendment would eliminate that activity on Lake Superior, the trolling with two lines on Lake Superior. So the committee should just be aware that there are some issues beyond just the overall impacts.
Representative Dill.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I think it was rather interesting when you said, I got kind of chuckle out of when you talked about McDonald's Lake, because frankly, one of the most beautiful places in the state is Voyageurs National Park, and I don't think there's any secret that for a few decades at least, that Rainy Lake and Captogama and Crane and Nanakin all in Voyageurs National Park. I used to kid that during Commissioner Sando's tenure in the DNR that I was going to rename one of my lakes up in my district McDonald's Lake, because it was the home of the quarter pounder. And luckily, that fishery has recovered. It's a beautiful fishery, and the Rainy Lake, I think the story is well told. Mm-hmm. So is Crane, where I live, and all of that. But, I mean, the fact is that you have rulemaking authority, including emergency rulemaking authority, that if Red Lake or Mille Lacs or any of those were affected by this, you would be able to step in at least on an interim basis and do something. And the legislature could come back then, and if this were to pass, and make some adjustments statutorily if necessary at another time. Is that correct on that rulemaking authority and the emergency rulemaking authority, or can you give me some idea of how that would work?
Mr. Boggess.
Mr. Chair and Representative Dill, we do have some broad rulemaking authority to do regulations, and then some expedited authority for when there's some sort of an emergency condition that can. It doesn't have to be like a natural disaster type emergency. It can be just something where we've got new data that doesn't allow us time to go through the normal process in order to protect a population of wild animals or fish. So we do have some broad authority, and I think what Mr. Peterson was saying is that in response to Representative Anderson's question, it was that we really don't know. We will be evaluating if this goes into effect, and if we do see an indication of a loss in quality, or if our data analysis of our existing data shows that's likely to happen, we would have the ability to tighten up those restrictions. We just want people to go into this with their eyes open that may in fact occur if this becomes law.
Thank you. All those in favor of the 271 say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay?
Nay.
Nay.
Okay, the motion's adopted. We have a list of about six or seven, maybe it's even almost 10 folks that want to testify. I would like to allow, as they come down for their 2 minutes, some questions from the members if they have them. First, we have Mr. Goldman, and then second, Howard Goldman is first, and then second will be Joel Carlson. And then if you could identify, a number of the citizens are testifying to different parts of the bill. So if you could let us know what parts of the bill interest you, that would help us. Welcome, Mr. Goldman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Howard Goldman. I'm the Minnesota State Director for the Humane Society of the United States, and I'm also representing the Minnesota Humane Society. I have a few brief comments on two topics in this bill, the bounties on coyotes and the season on sandhill cranes. I think with regard to bounties, I think the record is pretty clear. Bounties don't work. It proved ineffective in Minnesota. Ended in 1965 after almost 100 years. They ended in North Dakota in 1961 after $2 million was spent on coyote and fox bounties. Bill Berg, now retired, but he was with the Minnesota DNR as a research wildlife biologist, studied coyotes for almost 20 years and concluded that bounties have very little impact on coyote numbers. Coyotes are very adaptable. They have a high reproductive rate. Some biologists have concluded that you'd have to reduce the population by almost two-thirds to have any long-term benefits. In addition, coyotes are unprotected. They can be taken year-round on limited numbers. And we believe there's better ways to resolve coyote problems than to establish bounties. They're expensive. Guard dogs have proved to be effective, fencing, burros, even llamas in some cases. Secondly, I'd like to talk briefly about the sandhill crane population, which crashed in the early 1900s. It hadn't rebounded for almost 90 years. Been protected until last year. Season was set under expedited emergency game and fish rules. There was no public input whatsoever. There's very little research on the effect of a season on crane populations in Minnesota. Virtually no population estimates in Minnesota. There were some numbers in the 1980s, but there's no current population estimates. Cranes have a very low reproductive rate. On average, they produce one chick a year. Breeding doesn't begin till the age of two, goes perhaps as late as age seven, and we believe, therefore, that there should not be a season in Minnesota until public hearings have been conducted, and we fully understand the impact of a season on the crane populations.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Goldman? Thank you. Nick? Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Canute.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is just for a point of information. I'm not sure on the allowing county boards to offer a bounty for the taking of coyotes or beaver. How long has it been since we've had the ability to offer a bounty for either of those species?
Well, Representative Knud, I was younger than you. DNR, can you come down and this, Mr. Bogus, do you know how long it's been since we've had bounty on? I remember it on Fox. We didn't even have coyotes back then, but we probably had a bounty on them also. Mr. Bogus.
Mr. Chair and Representative Knuth, the state bounties for predators were eliminated in 1965.
Representative Knuth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so this is allowing county boards presumably to save us money at the state level, but have counties been allowed to offer bounties for
Mr.
any
Bogus.
Species?
Mr. Chair and Representative Knuth, the bounty appropriation in 1965, I believe, was vetoed by the governor at that time, and then later the law was changed to eliminate those species from the list that counties are allowed to offer bounties on. So current law allows counties to offer bounties on gophers and ground squirrels, and that's it.
Thank you, Mr. Bogus. Mr. Carlson.
Thank you,
Mr.
Chair.
Goldman. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Joel Carlson. I own a legal research and government affairs business here in St. Paul. And, Mr. Chairman, I have a couple issues in the bill. Do you want me to just do them at one time, or you want me to come back up for an additional whack at it?
Okay. Questions?
I have three issues, Mr. Chairman. I'll just hit them all three at the same time.
Go ahead and hit them.
For members, as some of you know, I'm an avid outdoorsman and sportsman, and I think I got the opportunity here to remind people that tomorrow night the chairman is the host of the Capital Chapter of Ducks Unlimited for our annual banquet over at the Kelly Inn at 6 o'clock, and it's a great event, and hope people can attend. I'm a nut about duck hunting, and I really don't want you to take away my right to chop my decoys out of the shoreline that I leave out overnight, as is required in Section 48 on page 19 of the bill. I have two client issues I want to bring up to you. I represent the Congress of Minnesota Resorts, and I want you to know that I haven't had a chance to ship out the new two-line fishing amendment to them for their review, but just nothing generates more discussion among resorters than the two-line fishing and the impact on the fishery and the potential for reduced bag limits. So we do have a concern in that. We're happy to watch that move forward. But just want you to know that that is a very important issue for resorters, and we want to watch that very, very carefully. The only other issue, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to bring to the members' attention is on Section 59 of the bill, and it deals with the walk-in access program. And my concern about the bill is that we're trying to change the law in a way that is inconsistent. And it's not that I have a problem with the content of or the objective of the language, but I think I had the page hand out to you what the current law is right now relative to the recreational use of leased land to the state, and you'll note that that land that is leased to the state or any political subdivision for recreational purpose is already covered in the language that is on Section 59. I brought this up with Representative Hackbarth and the DNR. I know he's got a lot of stops with the bill. I don't want to have an additional one at civil law and judiciary, but this is not needed, and it creates a confused state of the law by saying a charge is not a charge. And we fight that routinely. The current law that says leased property for recreational use is already covered by the recreational use statute, should be good enough to cover the walk-in program, and I'd like to not change the law and create a confusion relative to the charge that's in the bill right now. So those are my comments. Happy to answer questions, but I'd ask that you consider removing Section 59 from the bill as being unneeded and creating a confused state of the law.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Next, we'll hear from, we've got some folks that I think want to testify about fishing. Mr. Ness and Mr. Lilienthal, if you could come down. And then the last group I have are I think it's folks on the deer provision, Zone 300. There are a couple other folks, I apologize, on the fishing. We'll do them before we do the deer. Mr. Ness, I'm going to have to ask you to adhere to the 2 minutes, please. Mr. Ness.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Lance Ness. I'm the president of the Fish and Wildlife Legislative Alliance and Anglers for Habitat. I have with me Mr. Jim Lilienthal. He's a technical advisor chairman of our board. I'll let him talk about the northern slot limits. Quickly, for the record, Mr. Chairman, we're in opposition to the two-line section and the northern slot limit section. We would ask those two sections be limited, respectfully, sections 50 and 55. And I'll turn it over to Mr. Lilienthal.
Mr. Lilienthal.
Chairman McNamara, I've had an opportunity to serve this state for 38 and a half years. I retired in 2008. Last 25 years, I was instrumental in some of the northern pike regulations that were developed. We're, to say the least, I'm very proud of what has gone into those. They weren't rushed into. They took, as I said, they've been a product of close to 25 years of management efforts and research efforts to improve the quality of northern pike fishing, and they have accomplished that. Most of the information that has come out on these accomplishments has come out in the last, last year. I have actually got one study that was done in Senator Engelbretson's backyard that was a postcard study to try to capture the attitude of anglers in there from a rural perspective. And that was one of the most enlightening things that I've seen. For instance, 70% of all spears that were interviewed said they wanted to see more medium to large size northern pike. That's what these regulations do. 76% of spearers had fished these regulated lakes. Now, you know, you've heard a lot of talk about these being exclusionary, but 76% of the spearers were using these regulated lakes. And that's that was the highest user group of comparative anglers. 81% of those spearers also angle. We've given them that option, so they have two options when they're out there fishing on these regulated lakes as opposed to unregulated. And the final point I want to make is we have one regulated lake for every 12,500 anglers. We have one unregulated lake for every 4.5 spearers. Who's being left out here?
Thank you, Mr. Lilienthal. Question. Thank you. Next we have some folks on the pike slots, Tim Spalk and Roger Corsett. I'm sorry, Roger, I'm butchering your name, both of you. If you could come forward. And then is it a Wayne Boxer from Cass Lake? I don't know if you're all together. Again, folks, remember the 2 minutes. Introduce yourself for the record.
Hi, my name is Roger Geschel. I'm with the Minnesota Dark House Association and MOHA. I would like to talk about these the 60 lakes. When this regulation came out, we were behind this. The original lakes were listed. The DNR said these were the lakes that were most important that could produce perhaps these trophy nords. This is what they wanted to try to do. They were listed, 66 of them actually. There were two. I'm going to show you a map here of one of Mr. Lilienthal's area and what's happened out there. Originally, two lakes in Todd County, Long Lake and Bass Lake. These were two recommended. What he's done out there, all of these lakes that are in yellow, he has closed with slot limits. As he's telling you, all these people that Dark House guys love these, they don't. They do not go to these lakes. If they're out there fishing, they're angling for something else. They're not spearing pike because there's nothing to take when you have a 24 to 36 slot there's nothing to take. This pink one out here, he had a meeting to close this lake. And what he did was there was 100 and some people there. And what happened was those people overwhelmingly turned him down. And so this is these things I will give to Representative Hackbarth for his use down the road.
Thank you. Who's next? If you could introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tim Spreck. I'm president of the Minnesota Dark Horse Angling Association. I want to speak again also to the 60 lake provision of the bill that you're looking at today. I'm not going to plow any ground we haven't already testified about, but it's important that you know that when the DNR comes down here and they state to you that these regulations are working, that this is in effect a falsehood in a vast majority of the cases. The DNR needs to be held to the fire, and they need to justify that they're seeing results on these lakes. What they're doing is they're regulating for the sake of regulation, and part of what they've been doing over the last number of years is basically catering to lake associations that don't want people on their lakes. If you look at the graphic that was handed out to you today, I want you to look at the graph on the top. This looks impressive, but what it tells you is that in one instance on one lake and one fishing contest that they had shown some results over the years. That's wonderful. Maybe that lake should be considered as one of the 60. What we're telling you is that if they want to have broad-based regulation statewide, they need to come to you with more than one lake. Let's look down here a little bit farther. Here again we have one lake where they're showing some results. If they want to regulate broad-based and statewide, they need to show you what's happening on 115-plus lakes that they're regulating, and they're not doing that. They're cherry-picking two pieces of information. The study that's been done cherry-picks about seven lakes where they're showing some improvement, and what we're telling you today is that limiting opportunities statewide for people who have a legitimate and honest right to harvest fish is not supported by a minority of a tiny fraction of the lakes that are regulated. And I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Spreck. Next testifier, please introduce yourself for the record.
Members of the committee, my name is Wayne Bond, and I am a member of the Cass Lake Initiative for Spearing, and I'd like to address specifically a couple of comments made by Mr. Peters from the DNR. In testimony, he made a comment with regard to the impact of spearing on muskie population. In testimony before the Senate committee, it was stated pretty much categorically that the DNR has found no connection between spearing and muskie populations, although it has been sidetracked to become a issue of northern pike. They have not substantiated any direct connection as required, I believe, under the statute, the enabling statute to close Cass Lake, that there is any connection between spearing and muskies. There was a testimony by Major Smith, I believe, was the enforcement officer, who said that in preparation for that hearing, he'd done some research and has indicated that there was exactly one citation in the last 5 years issued in the entire state for spearing of a muskie. This is something that has not been a problem. For 23 years, we've had to wait for an opportunity to access the lake, and I think that it was a little bit disingenuous, some of the statements that were made to you, and I wanted to clarify that. With regard kind of to Section 62 and also with some of the issues, the comments that have been made by the DNR, that's the deer hunting antler regulations, but I think it ties into a comment I'd like to make generally with regard to some of these other things, is that the Minnesota Constitution recognizes the heritage and tradition of hunting and fishing in the state, and I frankly, in my opinion, the heritage and the tradition of hunting and fishing in the state of Minnesota is more towards sustenance for your family and for food and not for trophies, and I do take some exception to the continued efforts by the DNR to manage our public resources for the limited purposes of trophy hunting for some, and I think I'm well under my 2 minutes. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Bond. Are there any questions from the committee for the Dark Horse testifiers? Seeing none at this time, do we have any other testifiers in relation to the fishing issues in the bill? Seeing none, we will then move ahead into the Zone 3 discussion. The first testifier on my list is Ross Reedon. Sorry if I have butchered your name, Ross. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee. My name is Ross Reedon. I'm a private landowner. I'm a dairy farmer from southeast Minnesota. I'm specifically opposed to the Section 62 of House File 948, the Delete Everything Amendment. Just I guess it, as a fact, in 2008, 22 states had antler point restrictions in this country. The DNR here in Minnesota has been experimenting with antler point restrictions since 2005, specifically St. Croix State Park and Itasca State Park, where, interestingly, hunter satisfaction increased in 2005 from 59% approval to 74% approval in 2007. Itasca was 47, increased to 59. I have a problem with the amendment because it's circumventing the process that the DNR, the studies, the research, the roundtables, the public hearings, for years, probably close to 10 years, have been building toward this management change, and I'd call it an experimental change. They've agreed to try this antler point restriction specifically for 3 years and then reevaluate. And so I would encourage the committee to oppose this amendment and allow the DNR to do its job and allow them to evaluate and gather information to make a decision. One other pertinent information, 2% in Iowa, 2% of all their land is public hunting. In Minnesota, we have 25% of all of our public land is public hunting land. That's 2009 data. That tells me that there's more reason than ever to manage publicly versus private because of our abundance of public land. That pretty much does it for my comments. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Question. Thank you. Jed Hamill, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you before you today. Thank you, members. I as well am opposed to Section 62, the amendment before you here today. A lot went in to the regulations presented by the DNR. Many, many years of work, over 10 years of work with roundtables, surveys early on in 2001, 2005, 2008 to see if a change is needed. The regulations have been in place for many years, except right now this is just an experimental project going on for 3 years. The amendment before you today is trying to circumvent that and stop it in its tracks. Throughout the process, the rulemaking process, there were public hearings, there was transparency. Today, it would eliminate all the work placed in by the DNR in trying to implement this plan. Other states are having great success with the restrictions that is placed upon, including antler restrictions and season, date, and time. So that is what the DNR is doing, and the majority of people that I've talked to, I'm an attorney down in southeastern Minnesota, all are in favor of this, to keep going with the process in place, and they are also opposed to what is brought before the committee here today. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hamill. Questions? Representative Anderson, if you could Thank stay there, Mr. Hamill.
Mr. Hamill.
If you could stay there. Question. Mr. Representative Chairman. Anderson.
I just would like to ask Mr. Hamill if, in his opinion, the discovery of chronic wasting disease at all changes the parameters and the objectives for this type of program in the need to harvest more deer down in that area.
I don't,
Mr. Hamill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Anderson, I don't believe it does change that at all. Right now, it's the antler restrictions. You can there's plenty of opportunity, especially with the two seasons in place, that you can shoot antlerless deer. I don't think that changes it at all, as well as the seizing dates. The DNR is going to need to have that tool, whether it's going to be a seven-day season or a nine-day season, needs to have that tool in order to regulate if there is a problem with chronic wasting disease in the future.
Thank you. Next, we have Mr. Fitch from the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association Bluff Country Chapter. If you could come down, and after Mr. Fitch, I've got a Mr. Godin, who's, I think, with Quality Deer Management Association. Mr. Fitch, I'll remind you of the 2 minutes. Thank you and welcome to the committee. If you could identify yourself for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Name's Perry Fitch, landowner, farmer, as well as a full-time roofing worker in southeast Minnesota. Live near Winona. Hunting-wise, participate in archery, shotgun season, as well as muzzleloader. Currently the state director for the Bluff Country Chapter of the MDHA. I take pride in mentoring youth hunters on my farm. Biggest thrill I have is helping a youth harvest a deer. It's not necessarily for myself. It's to have the kids do it. I read a statement from the MDHA, as I can speak for them. Current board position is in opposition to mandatory buck management tactics, earn a buck, APRs, etc. Without clear public support and a significant majority without sharing clear need or showing clear need for the biological health of the deer herd. These rules have nothing to do with the biological health of our deer herd. And just a statement to read on them. The two rules in effect here, cross-tagging. Cross-tagging is broadly defined as allowing individuals to shoot and tag a deer for each other. This is a very narrow definition. Cross-tagging may be considered the right to shoot a wounded buck that has escaped another hunter or your child. This is currently illegal and makes you a poacher. Cross-tagging may be considered you shot a buck in the archery season, can no longer shoot a buck for your father in the family hunt. Cross-tagging may be illegal in states like Iowa, but you can shoot three bucks in Iowa. Minnesota, you're allowed one deer per licensed hunter. Cross-tagging is resulting in a drop of hunters. DNR is asking for a raise in hunters, or a raise in license fees, and they are losing hunters because of these two regulations. APRs is the same thing, making criminals out of hunters. People shooting a spike buck during the doe season, they leave the deer lay in the woods. There's no choice, or you're guilty. Prime example, Rushford, during the opening day of the 3A gun season, a pickup load of deer confiscated by the local warden. Fortunately, they were given to the Rushford school, but they were all illegal deer. The people got a warning for it. Did they get tickets? I don't know if they got tickets, but they did get a warning. How many of these people are not coming back to hunt in Minnesota?
Thank
I would guess the majority.
Thank you, Mr. Fitch.
Thank you.
Question. Next, we'll hear from Mr. Gooden. I apologize if I didn't pronounce it right. And after that is Mr. Drache. Sorry, we're trying to read everybody's different
writing.
Thank
you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome. If you could identify yourself for the record, 2 minutes.
Phil Gaden, Alexandria, Minnesota. I'm vice president of the state chapter of the Quality Deer Management Association. I'm here to oppose the amendment, Section 62, that would eliminate the recent changes to Zone 3 deer hunting. The Quality Deer Management Association is a national organization with over 50,000 members. Over 1,500 of those members are professional wildlife managers, professors, biologists. Quality Deer Management Association supports the changes that the DNR implemented last season in Zone 3 to protect yearling bucks and improve the quality of the deer herd. Many hunters unfamiliar with quality deer management incorrectly assume QDM is only about large antlered bucks. In simplest terms, QDM involves balancing the deer herd with the habitat and deer, bucks and does in multiple age classes. Most areas have a good age structure for the doe population, but very few places have the same age structure for the buck population. Typical buck populations include a high percentage of yearlings. This young age structure is a direct result of harvest pressure by hunters. In the past, most hunters focused intense pressure on yearling bucks and removed the majority of that age class. Before antler point restrictions were implemented in Pennsylvania in 2002, hunters removed over 80% of the yearling bucks on an annual basis. With that removal rate, less than 1% of the Pennsylvania's bucks ever reach maturity. Yearling bucks are the easiest adult deer to harvest. Quality deer management's helped correct this imbalance by protecting yearling bucks and allowing them to survive into the older age classes. This not only improves hunter satisfaction, but improves the health and social interaction within the deer herd. Pennsylvania started, like I said, in 2002. There was much fighting to get to that point, and even a book was written about it called Deer Wars. Since it began, it has gained popularity, has been extremely successful. Many other states have implemented APR with similar results. I have no doubt the same result will be duplicated in southeast Minnesota.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you, Mr. Gaden. Next, we have Brian Drackney. I'm sorry, again, we don't have a good list here, you guys. Go ahead, if you could identify yourself for the record, 2 minutes.
Brian Drackney from Winona, Minnesota.
I'm here to ask you to support the bill that's been introduced as Section 62 that Representative Drazkowski's put in. I do have a letter here from another individual that was not able to attend. Several petitions, four separate ones, that have been introduced to Drazkowski here, two of which were directed, you know, with the help of the MDHA and South, but two of them unprompted been sent his way. They were due to the overwhelming objection to these two rules. The majority of the three Zone 3 hunters are family groups called in the press mom and pop hunters or meat hunters. These petitions are proud to be belong to these two groups. What hunting is about, not antlers only. With these two rules implemented in 2010 hunting season, several problems arose. Some were all well documented in the local newspapers. Antler deer were harvested only to discover the lack of 4 points on one side, even though deer supported a larger set of antlers. The meat hunters and mom and pop hunters were actually attempt to control the population by harvesting the does. To only find out that the doe actually had a 4-inch spike buck on it, so it's actually it had only had two horns, so it was an illegal deer, which resulted in the deer being left in the woods. I want to bring up a CWWD. Someone brought that up earlier. You know, basically managing for antler point restrictions is actually making the deer herd older class deer. Why would we want to voluntarily increase the age structure of a deer herd that not only would increase the possibility of spreading the disease that nobody has a real understanding on how it is spread and has no treatment for this disease? I mean, that's a very good question to the DNR. Why would somebody implement a regulation such as APRs that would significantly increase the potential of CWD? Thank you.
Thank you. Next and last, we have Mr. Peterson. Welcome, Mr. Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Tom Peterson. I represent the Minnesota Farmers Union, and it's not an issue that I usually would jump in on, but it's probably one of the issues I've gotten the most calls on from our members that want to know, and so we are supportive of Section 62, and for many of the same reasons that you've heard about today, and as well as chronic wasting disease concerns, and the antler points. And so I just wanted to weigh in on that and urge your consideration for keeping that in the bill. And I wanted to point out we also support the coyote provision strongly, and we are interested in continuing to work on the walk-in access provision to make sure that. Whether you take it in or take it out, we want to continue to look at that liability issue. Thank you.
Well, I appreciate you working on all those and for mentioning the last one. Questions for Mr. Peterson? Okay, I think that's all. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If Dr. Cornicelli could come forward, I have a couple questions for him.
Dr. Cornicelli, if you could come down, and I apologize to the audience, I did not ask. Is there anyone else that wants to speak for or against any provisions in the bill? Is there anybody in the audience who hasn't spoke who wants to speak for or against any provisions of the bill? Okay, we're going to continue through with just questions from the members to ask if they have questions. We won't have any more audience testimony. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Cornicelli, in the Zone 300 series, there are a number of hunters who may not be able to make it to a meeting or may not come to the Capitol because they're driving buggies. And so I'd like to know what the outreach was in southeastern Minnesota relating to all the changes on with the Amish community.
Dr. Cornicelli, welcome back.
Thank you, Representative, Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen. For the record, Lou Cornicelli, Big Game Program Coordinator, Minnesota DNR. We did as best we could with the Amish community. You know, there's only certain ways to get a hold of them. We had, you know, six public meetings in the southeast through the course of this, and I know there was some word of mouth with the local BWA members with the Amish community. We actually did have a half a dozen Amish folks show up to a couple of different public meetings, and they actually expressed some support for what we were doing. So, you know, I've chatted with them you know, when I bump into them when I'm down there, and a couple did come to the meeting. So I think there was a little bit. I think they're aware of the issue. We didn't hear from them negatively or positively at the end of the season. So I don't know if that answers your question, but we did attempt a little bit, but it's difficult, as you can imagine.
Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Follow up on a different subject. We've heard testimony today about deer in the field related to changes, and you know, I've experienced finding deer in the field, and how whatever changes we do, whatever happens in this bill or every other year as we keep tweaking and changing here, how do we deal with that loss? The mortality on deer from wounded animals or inadvertent kills, you know, because I think folks, whatever the regulation is, they don't want to have something go to waste that's a public resource. How do we deal with that, and how have other states tried to deal with that?
Dr. Cornicelli.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanson, yeah, we definitely take the, whether it's illegal harvest or what to do with the carcass once we discover it, pretty seriously. You know, you make a good point. We have wounding loss in every season with every method. We have people routinely in lottery areas that have existed since 1910 who take antlerless deer without a permit. Sometimes they find someone with a permit. Sometimes they turn themselves in. Those deer are ultimately distributed to local folks who are on a list. The law enforcement will typically, and I can't speak entirely for them, so Major Smith can correct me if I'm incorrect, but when we confiscate a deer, typically we have a list of people, and that deer gets donated to a person so it doesn't go to waste. In the case of the antler point restriction, specifically from Zone 3, we had a number of people, I think it was between 12 and 18, who turned themselves in for taking a sublegal buck, and that deer was donated. It wasn't the extensive problem that we had initially heard or were hearing today. It certainly happens. It happens everywhere. So we take that seriously, deal with folks as it comes up, and then try and distribute that carcass in the best possible way. In other states, I'm honestly unsure what they do, but I would suspect, I've worked in a couple different states, and we approached it the same way, you know, an interview, warning, citation, and then disposition of the carcass.
Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dr. Cornicelli, the 12 to 18 that did turn themselves in, what was the penalty or the citation that they received?
Dr. Cornicelli.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanson, I'll have to have Major Smith correct.
Major Smith.
Hopefully I'm right, but I think it was all warning.
Mr. Chair. For the record, Major Rodman Smith, Operations Manager, DNR Enforcement, and to answer your question, Representative Hanson, what about 12 to 18 people turned themselves in for shooting a sub-legal deer in Zone 3 this year, and they were all received written warnings, and the deer were confiscated and then gifted to somebody on a list that we had?
Major, did any of them lose their hunting privileges?
Mr. Chair, no. They were given written warnings.
Thank you. Additional questions, Representative Hanson. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To that point, Mr. Cornicelli or Major Smith, do you suspect that there were more or less people that didn't turn themselves in that found themselves in the same violation predicament?
Major Smith.
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, we heard anecdotally a lot of stories about all these dead deer in the woods, and we tried to track down a lot of these stories, and it's always seemed like it was somebody that knew a guy that knew a guy that saw the deer, or it was, we could never get to the individual specifically. We did not have valid reports to our officers that there were an increased number of deer in the woods laying dead that presumably were shot, that were sublegal, and then just shot and left in the woods. We could never confirm any of that. It was a lot of anecdotal information that we'd received.
Representative Drazkowski, additional questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do, and Mr. Chair and members, I've got some handouts that I put together, and I guess I'd certainly like to talk with Mr. Cornicelli about some of this, but one of the members is a map of the different permit areas in the state, and it just happens to be the 2009 one from the DNR publication that I printed off, but because that's the one I could find. But it shows the different permit areas, and the area members we're talking about are all of those that are 300 or the 300 that are in the 300s. So that is the those collectively are the zone we're talking about. If you look at the map, you'll see I wrote CWD on. That's approximately the area that the CWD was discovered, where there were very large concentrations of deer measured by the DNR this last couple of months. And then if you look at the very east, 346 and 349 are the areas on the east side of that area that the DNR, in one of the publications I read, is cited as an area that are very much overpopulated, that they would like to really focus in on reducing population. Some of the other things I handed out, one is the survey results that were talked about earlier from the 2009 survey, both the pertinent survey results on one side that look at the level of support for the APR and the cross-tagging prohibition. And as you'll see on top, the questions were asked at one point in the survey, and then they were asked in another way later in the survey. And you'll see both of those questioning regimes outlined on the back of that sheet. The other handouts here, members, are the summaries from the DNR publications that show their deer harvest numbers both statewide and within the 3A and 3B zones. And members, 3A and 3B are basically the same area, but they're two different time periods. So if you're going to measure the area geographically, you would add them together. And so members, what I did on the 2010 one is basically calculated using the 2009 numbers, the total, what we saw as a reduction in the number of hunters in Zone 3 and the reduction in the number of harvest in Zone 3 of 6% decrease in hunters, 16% decrease in the deer kill, while a corresponding increase in hunters statewide, as you see towards the bottom of that table, and then a corresponding increase in the number of deer killed statewide on that bottom line. You'll see I also scribbled on the bottom the numbers, comparison of the numbers of the antlerless that were harvested in Zone 3 in 2009 and 2010, and the corresponding number of antlerless that were killed in the state in 2009. In 2010, and the reason those are included there, I think most of the research tells us that if we are going to reduce the very dense deer populations that are existing in both the western and eastern parts of this district, and I would, from what I hear from people, there are it's very common throughout the southern part of the region. If we're going to reduce and manage the deer population, that we need to look at the doe population. Maybe Mr. Cornicelli can talk about that, but before he does, the last item, members, is
Representative Drazkowski, do you have a question for Dr. Cornicelli?
I do. Can I proceed to this next one, Mr. Chair? Okay. The last one, members, is from the DNR's 2010 Zone 3 Deer Season Recommendations, pages 6 and 7. And this ostensibly was put together before the regulations were actually put into place last year, and gives us a picture of what they were anticipating in terms of an increase in the antlerless, and you'll see on the antlerless harvest on page 6, it's underlined there. 15% is what they were anticipating for an antlerless increase. And then on page 7, you'll see them talking about the high concentrations in zones 346 and 349, 349. And then further down, the second star talks about looking at, and maybe Mr. Cornicelli can comment on this, looking at approximately 25% higher harvest is what was anticipated, and thought that those numbers could be brought down in a year or two. If you look at those tables at the bottom, I have superimposed the actual harvest numbers in 2010 over those that were estimated with the projected area. So,
is there a question in there, Representative?
I'm interested in Dr. Cornicelli's you know, kind of assessment of the reduction in hunter and kill numbers in Zone 3, given the fact that they both increased in the state.
Dr. Cornicelli.
Mr. Chair, Representative Draskowski, yes, the reduction in hunter numbers, I sent an email to Perry's group yesterday. I made a mistake in the 2010 harvest report with the new licenses that came about with youth hunters. Our system didn't pull them, so we actually I took about 2 hours yesterday and reran all the license numbers, and it was actually a 3.1% decrease in hunters from 2010 to 2009, but it puts it in the ballpark of what we've had since 2005. So it, functionally, if you're going to measure hunter numbers statistically, it's about the same. It's lower than 2009, but higher than 2006 or 7 or something like that. So the hunter numbers did decline a little bit. With respect to harvest rates, we made a couple estimates. The buck harvest rate was pretty straightforward, what the reduction would be. And we calculated that based on, as I talked about previously, a five-year research project that involved working deer tech stations in the zone. So we had a good sense of hunter success rates based on the ELS system. We had a good sense of percent yearling bucks in the harvest. So you can calculate, you know, you add party hunting to that, you can calculate about what that percentage reduction would be. And in the 2010 recommendations that I wrote, I think it must have been in April or March or April, before the deer season, I estimated a 30% reduction in buck harvest. It turned out it was like 32. So that's a pretty straightforward calculation that just happened. We hit that one right on. The antlerless harvest is one that's more difficult to measure because that changes. We have changes in designation. Things go from lottery to managed. They go from intensive to managed. They go from managed to lottery. So that antlerless is more difficult to measure. We didn't see the 15% increase. We saw that increase in some areas in the northern part of the zone, 341, 343. We didn't see it in 346, 349. We saw reductions in antlerless harvest in both those permanent areas, from archery to early antlerless through firearm and muzzleloader. And my sense is, in speaking with the local area managers and looking at our harvest data, that we're seeing reductions in those Winona and Houston County deer populations in general, and the harvest is reflecting that. The problems that we continue to have there are those large inholdings of private land where there's light harvest, and no regulation fixes that. You know, we could have an Ernebuck regulation, and what it would do is it overharvest public, the little bit of public land, but really have no impact on the 1,000 acres where people shoot two deer. So I think what's going on in the very southeast corner of the state is more complex than just doing simple math on what should the antlerless harvest do. And that was my mistake. I think we failed to factor a lot of those bigger picture things in when I came up with that estimate of the increase in antlerless harvest. But again, the buck was pretty straightforward. And I think, I don't know if I, does that answer the question?
Any follow-ups, Representative Draskowski?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks, Dr. Cornicelli.
Dr. Cornicelli, a couple questions from the chair. First, are there any extra young hunters, I guess. I'm trying to get my words together here. Do young hunters have any privileges that older hunters do not in this area?
Mr. Chair, absolutely they do. Since 2004, as it has been articulated previously, the 3A, 3B deer seasons are distinct. They're mutually exclusive. An adult cannot hunt both. It's been that way since the 70s. Up until 2003, that was also true for youth hunters. In 2004, we changed the youth regulations where now youth hunters, those are 10 to 17, can hunt statewide on a firearms license. So they can hunt 3A, 3B. So they get that 18 days of deer hunting opportunity that adults don't get. In addition, they can take an either sex deer without making a lottery application. So they can hunt 18 days, take whatever they want, and they're also specifically exempted from the antler point restriction. They don't have to comply with the 4 points on a side. Now, they do have to comply with the party hunting or the buck cross tagging, because that's an adult slash child youth issue. They can only take one antlered male, but it can be any antlered male. It can be over the course of the 3A, 3B seasons, and it can be statewide as well. So, yes, they get significant opportunity.
The age bracket again there, Dr. Cornicelli.
Mr. Chair, 10 to 17, so the youth license. So until their 18th birthday, they can pretty much do whatever they want.
Thank you. And one more question. We all have heard about CWD. How does, you know, you put these regulations together before CWD was discovered. Does that discovery and the dealing with that disease have any effect on your perspective on these regulations?
Mr. Chair, thanks for the opportunity to answer that question. Yes, it does. Quite frankly, the CWD zone that we'll carve out this fall will look a lot like the winter surveillance area that you saw up through now, and there won't be an antler point restriction. Assuming if this doesn't pass, there won't be an antler point restriction in that CWD zone. Our desire is to lower deer densities, to minimize that nose-to-nose contact on the landscape and not allow CWD to spread. However, the rest of the zone would still be under the regulations, and partly because we don't have any evidence to suggest that CWD is anywhere but in Pine Island. We've done a fairly robust sampling since 2002. Wisconsin has done the same along our border permit areas, and they've not found the disease. We've not found the disease other than, you know, 150 miles from Pine Island and in Pine Island. So, you know, if CWD were unfortunately detected, and we're going to do some pretty broad surveillance this fall around that positive deer in those permit areas, then it would certainly change the game with respect to antler point restrictions. But within the new CWD permit area that we'll create, there won't be those regulations.
Thank you, Dr. Cornicelli. And that CWD permit area, how large would it be? Is it all contained within what I have on this map listed as District 343?
Mr. Chair, it will likely resemble or be very close to the winter surveillance area, which is roughly a 10-mile radius bounded by roads around Pine Island. It would be County Highway 14 to the south, 63 to the east, 60 to the north, and Representative Quam 57 to the west, I think is what it would be. It's about 305 square miles. One of the reasons, you know, when we did our winter surveillance, we took that 10-mile radius, and if we didn't find any more positives, there's really no reason to make that area bigger. Now, we're going to do surveillance in 341 to 343 to the west in Zone 2, 345. And we may find another positive further away, which would again change the zone. But at this point in time, when we did the winter surveillance, one of the goals was to see if we could find it somewhere else, and we didn't. So there's no reason to make it any bigger. I'd be reticent to make it any smaller, because then it gets so small that you can't measure what you have on the landscape. So about 305 square miles. For reference, the TB management area up in the northwest is about 500 square miles.
Thank you. Representative Knuth, I believe, has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, I have a question on another issue that I'm wondering if we'll have time for, if other members have question on this issue.
I'm sorry. Representative Knuth, I did not hear your question. I thought it was
I'm
for
sorry.
Dr. Cornes.
I have a question on another issue, I think for the DNR, but I'm just hoping that we have a little time before the end of the committee.
Thank you. Representative Anderson, a question for
Thanks,
DNR.
Mr. Chair. Looking at the map that we have here with the zone numbers, 343 is the area that the CWD was found in. Could you comment, Dr. Cornicelli, on deer numbers in some of the other areas surrounding that? Are they high in all areas, or is that the highest concentration of deer numbers in 343?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, no, they're not. 341, 343, 345, they're probably middle of the road. We typically harvest between 4 and 4.5 deer per square mile in those permit areas. And we often will harvest about a quarter of the standing crop, so we could say there's 16 to 20 deer per square mile preseason. That's the average harvest in the state, I believe, is about 2.8 per square mile. So it's slightly over average, but the habitat in southeastern Minnesota is really good. In comparison, 346, 349, Houston, Winona counties, the very southeast, we've been very aggressive with deer populations down there for a long period of time. And they used to harvest 12 to 13 deer per square mile for reference. Now they're down in the 7 to 9, so they're down quite a bit. But for scale, you know, 2 to 3 times the densities in the very far southeast corner there were. Middle of the road in the areas we're talking around Rochester, the big difference with the winter is the winter concentrations when deer are very unevenly distributed on the landscape. That's why we saw the 20 to 80 deer per square mile. We wouldn't see that naturally in the fall.
Thank you. Any other questions in this area? If not, I believe Representative Hackbarth has another amendment to the bill.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, it's the A2 amendment that Ms. Taylor had drafted for us. This is something that was brought to me by the DNR, and I have Mr. Bogus, I think, would like to speak to the amendment. I think it's pretty straightforward.
Mr. Bogus, to the amendment.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you. This would just simply strike the prescriptive language currently in statute on the opening day shooting hours of the duck season for migratory birds and would give commissioner authority to set those hours on opening day. Commissioner Landwehr is interested in having a conversation with waterfowl hunters about potentially moving the opening day shooting hours earlier. Currently, shooting hours during the season are a half hour before sunrise on every day of the season except the opening day. So we'd appreciate the committee's consideration of this amendment.
Thank you. Any questions to the amendment?
And, Mr. Chairman, I think Chairman McNamara might want to take a look at this amendment.
It's a good provision, Representative Hackbart. I support it.
To the amendment, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed by the same sign.
No.
Mr. Chairman, now I believe Representative Dill has an amendment.
Representative Dill.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And actually, I'm not going to do the amendment because it has to do with Lake Superior and the two line. And when the chair and I were discussing this, we want to maybe take a look at how that affects those border lakes as well. And when we decided to do the border lake, Lake Pepin and the one out to the west, then suddenly it came into mind that there was Lake of the Woods and Rainy Lake and all of the other border lakes. Yep. So we want to make sure we have it right. And I just wanted to alert you as the author of the bill that we're going to be coming forward with some after we've had time to consult.
That's very good, Representative Dill. And, Mr. Chairman, I would probably support that, whatever we come up with.
Well, at some point, Representative Hackbart, if it stays the way it is, we'll have to address because we've got all kinds of issues on St. Croix River and everywhere else. Representative Dill.
Okay, thank you. And, Mr. Chairman, I'll just take this opportunity since we addressed the Lake Superior and other lakes issues. One thing that is in the bill, I am not in support of the decoy language. I'm not prepared to make an amendment to remove it at this time, but I just wanted to make that on the record. And the second item with regard to duck hunting as a rule, the word emergent is becoming more and more problematic over time. When the DNR is defeated in court over proving that there was emergent vegetation, that hunters are routinely, without really meaning to, violating the law of hunting without emergent vegetation, as an example, hunting on Lake of the Woods, bluebill hunting. There are small rock islands out there that there's not even a blade of grass on those islands. And people are hunting off of them, and they've been doing this for generations and generations, but they're technically in violation of the law. But the word emergent, members, keeps us from hunting from a boat that isn't partially concealed in emergent. Emergent is the thing that it grows out of the bottom. But if you go to us, our surrounding states, particularly the West, I wouldn't even hunt in those states if I couldn't hunt from a boat blind. I mean, that's lots of hunting, lots of people trying to hunt, lots of people buying licenses, and it's a very common practice. And I just want to alert the committee that that may be an amendment that's coming forth, and also the department that I may be considering that and like to work with them on it. And that being said, that's my concerns with game and fish probably for this year.
Thank you. Representative Hackbart, comment on that issue?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Dill and I have talked about that emergent issue, and I look forward to working with him to come up with some kind of a solution for that.
And I look forward to it too, Representative Hackbart. It's been a problem, Representative Dill. You make a good point. To the bill, Representative Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of technical amendments, cleanup language here, if you would indulge me. On page 19, thing with the lawful removal of beavers and lodges by road authorities. Brought to my attention that we don't need to notify the Board of Water and Soil Resources. So on page 19, line 11, I would move to strike the words "and the Board of Water and Soil Resources" from that section.
Representative Falk, to your potential amendment, do you mind if I also go to Representative Fabian? Representative Fabian had an idea with that same. Did you have more on that particular point? To the Falk oral amendment. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Falk, thank you for doing that. I've had conversations with Kent Solom from the townships and Julie Blackburn from Bowser and Mr. Bogus and Representative Falk and also the people back home, and we concur that that's a good move. Everybody does.
Okay. To the Falk Fabian amendment, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Amendments adopted. Representative Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have one additional technical amendment here, and it deals with the section with the coyote bounty because it becomes duplicative language to have the coyote and beaver bounties there. Okay. And the original intent of the Beaver Bounty was for road authorities, not for the purposes of just the county board authorizing them for any purpose. So if you would, on page 24, in the title of section 58, I would move to strike the words or beaver, and then on page 25, in lines 25.2, move to strike the words or beaver, parentheses castor canadensis. That would, it's, that should just be strictly the coyote bounty, that portion, not dealing with beavers.
To the Falk oral amendment, Mr. Boggess, comment?
Mr. Chair, from our perspective, that improves this section. Okay.
Well, once in a while we do that, Mr. Boggess. Discussion to Representative Falk's amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, nay. The Falk amendment's adopted. Representative Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Canute.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We haven't really had much of discussion about the Sandhill Crane issue, and I'm just sort of curious. I know there was a process by which it became legal to hunt Sandhill Cranes up in the northwest part of the state, and I'm just wanting to know because, one, first I have a question of how much time and effort or just how much money has been spent on getting this population back to a point where hunting made some ecological sense, and then what steps the DNR is taking, if they have a plan, what some of the outlines of the plan to make sure that we're not impacting either the sandhill crane population, and then also steps to make sure that we're not impacting the whooping crane populations in Minnesota because they could accidentally be taken, or, you know, just making sure that with this change that we've seen and a sense of how much it costs to get us to this point and then what steps are being taken to make sure that we don't go backwards.
Mr. Boggess.
Mr. Chair and Representative Knuth, just quickly, Minnesota has two populations, the sandhill cranes, the mid-continent populations, about a half million plus birds that occurs throughout Canada and the Great Plains states and touches the northwest corner of Minnesota. I could certainly provide, I know time is an issue right now, but I could certainly provide the committee with more information on this issue. But, you know, it's a very large range in the country with just a very small corner of Minnesota, and that's the most abundant population on the continent, and that's the one that we've been hunting. It's surveyed by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. There's also an eastern population of cranes that occurs from kind of eastern Canada down through eastern Minnesota, Wisconsin, Tennessee, Kentucky, down into Florida, and that population has been increasing. It's not hunted anywhere. There is an eastern population management plan that does call for the potential for hunting, particularly in some of the states where they're causing some damage to agriculture, like Tennessee, Kentucky, and some of those places. There is also a new eastern whooping crane population that's being experimentally established in Wisconsin to Florida, and they sometimes do show up in Minnesota. So that's a valid concern, and we have been talking with Audubon, and I know they've distributed some information here today, and we have committed to doing a plan for sandhill crane management in the state that accounts for both populations, that talks about survey needs and population management needs. So we are certainly not wanting to do anything that's going to affect the conservation of these populations or of whooping crane reestablishment in an eastern population. So, you know, in the interest of time, I would just say we are committed to working on that. I could certainly provide you, Representative Knuth, with more detail about that or the committee, if you'd like, Mr. Chair, on this issue.
Well, Mr. Boggess, thank you. And we did get a handout from Audubon. They asked if they could pass it out. They did not need to testify. If you could get us more information, that'd be great. Representative Knuth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, it would be helpful if you could share more information with me about the progression of the conservation plan and the relationships between the different populations.
Thank you, Representative Knuth. Members, we are going to keep going to finish the bill. The next committee is not in place, but I know that many of you have 10-15 appointments, so we will keep going. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Boggess, could you briefly describe the number of licenses and the success rate for that hunt last year of sandhill cranes?
Mr. Bogus.
Mr. Chair and Representative Torkelson, we're required by federal law because sandhill cranes are a federally classified migratory game bird, and they do require that we have a permit for all the hunters so that they can be surveyed individually. That survey is done by the Fish and Wildlife Service, and we don't have the final results of it yet. We had over 1,900 permits issued. We had about 750 active hunters, according to some preliminary data that we've gotten from that survey, and they took a little over 700 cranes in the preliminary data that we've gotten. Those numbers could change when the final survey results are in, but this is out of an overall harvest of between 20 and 30,000. The mid-continent population is hunted by all the states in the central flyway that have cranes that migrate through there, except Nebraska. They're not hunted in Nebraska because there's a major staging area there, and so they're protected in that state. But the total harvest is between 20 and 30,000, and we probably took about 700.
Representative Torkelson.
Of that, of the population, what percentage of that population overall goes through the state of Minnesota?
Mr. Bogus.
Mr. Chair and Representative Torkelson, I right now can't put a percentage on it, but of its range, it's a tiny fraction of its range intersects the northwestern corner of Minnesota. This population has a huge range from Alaska to eastern Arctic of Canada, and then it funnels down through the central flyway, so it's a small portion of its range. Our small corner of that and any hunting that would go on there is not going to have a significant population level effect, but we also don't want to have an effect on breeding cranes in the state either. So we want to manage for both, the overall population in North America and also the Minnesota breeding birds.
Thank you. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first, I would request a roll call on the bill.
Okay. Representative Hansen requests a roll call. There will be a roll call. Representative Hansen.
Second, Mr. Chair, the motion is the route for this bill going to include the Ag Committee?
Representative Hackbart, if I'm not mistaken, your motion is to go to GovOp next. Do you have an idea? You've mentioned a few that you have to go to or that are going to, as far as total number of committees that you may be going to, or specifically Department of Ag.
Mr. Chairman, yes, I know that because of the new hunting license that's in this bill, I do have to go to taxes and I do have to go to Ways and Means to appropriate the money out.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The specific provisions I'm looking at are Section 2 and the elk compensation, where we're expanding the eligibility for compensation that deals with the budget that is still limited, and also the amendment we put on relating to the swine release. So those are the provisions that may need a stop in agriculture, potentially because that ag budget is what's affected under the compensation for the elk.
Mr. Bogus or Representative Hackbart?
Well, Mr. Chairman, we've had these provisions in these bills before, and I don't ever recall ever having to go to ag for those issues.
Well, Representative Hackbart, Representative Hansen's raised a question about the swine, but aren't we talking about...
This is not, Mr. Chairman, this is not farm swine.
That was my understanding. These are the...
We specifically...
Feral pigs that we see hunted on videos, is that...
We specifically exempt farm swine out of this provision.
Mr. Bogus, comment?
Mr. Chair, the swine provisions in the invasive and injurious section of statutes, and it's to deal with people that want to release swine for establish them in the wild, and that is occurring in some other states like Michigan, where hunt clubs are intentionally releasing swine to have a species to hunt basically year round. And in our in our discussions with certainly Board of Animal Health and ag staff, they do not want to see feral swine get established in the state. and we cooperated in a report to the legislature 2 years ago on this issue. The one piece of that that we haven't yet addressed that this bill is attempting to address is the is a penalty for intentional introduction of swine into the wild. So I don't know what committees it has to go to, but I know we've had discussions with our ag counterparts on that issue.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to see where, if it was going to go to agriculture. I think to the bill, and I realize we're nearing time, but like most game and fish bills, this one is also a grab bag. There are a few prizes in here, but there's also some junk that hopefully will be removed as it goes through the process. But I would encourage folks in, as a total, to vote against the bill.
Thank you. Comments to the bill? Clerk will take the roll.
McNamara?
Aye.
Anderson?
Yes.
Beard? Dill?
Yes.
Druskowski?
Yes.
Fabian?
Yes.
Falk?
No.
Heckworth?
Aye.
Hancock?
Aye.
Hansen?
No.
Hilty?
No.
Knuth?
No.
Purcell?
Aye.
Quam?
Aye.
Scott? Torkelson?
Aye.
Wagenius?
There being 10 ayes and 4 nays, the bill is passed and moved to GovOps. Members, we have the minutes of March 31st before us. Representative Quam, could you move the minutes of March 31st? Representative Quam moves the minutes of March 31st. Discussion? All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion carries. Members, we do not plan to meet tomorrow or Thursday. The intention would be next Tuesday. We'll begin to take up some energy bills, the lands bill. I think Representative Fabian is going to chair a land subcommittee. The hope is that it would take place. There's a potential opportunity for an afternoon time frame in the 2:15. I think the members on the subcommittee is Representative Hilty, Representative Dill, Representative Hackbart, and is it Representative Paul Anderson? Or I'm sorry, and Representative Paul Anderson, I believe. Those five members. The thoughts are that they'll hear the bill one afternoon in that 2 to 4 time frame, because a lot of people are going to come from out state to testify on the lands bill, and then we would take the bill up the next morning in our committee, kind of maximizing the people coming from out state could travel in the morning, attend Representative Fabian's subcommittee, and then be available to only have to stay overnight one night, still allowing them, because some will come from far northern Minnesota, potentially from southern Minnesota. Questions on process? Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there any intent? I think there's several bills that were introduced that deal with environmental bonding, and that would probably that have been assigned to this committee. And if there's a bonding bill, whenever that is, would have to go through. Do you intend to hear some of those bills? I know there's the Reinvest in Minnesota. There's some other ones that are environmental bonding. Just wondering a roadmap on that.
Representative Hansen, as you and I have talked, there is a bill, Representative Hansen's bill, for Reinvest in Minnesota bonding that I've expressed to Representative Howes, that if we're going to be doing a bonding bill, we would want to hear some bonding bills before this committee. Representative Clark has a bonding bill, and I'm missing somebody else in the committee here has talked to me specifically about a bonding bill proposal. It is my intention before before Representative Howes, Chairman Howes, would do his bill that we would hear bonding, but I think that's farther down the list. But if I just talked to Representative Howes yesterday on the House floor about that. Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was wondering if at this time you could let us know which energy bills you are intending to hear.
Representative Hilty, I would like you and Representative Beard to work together on what bills you think we should hear. In FYI, there are some, we've heard a number of bills, but some of the more controversial ones dealing with renewable energy standards, I anticipate we will not have time to hear some of those. So if that's some of the ones you're wondering about, Representative Hilty, I don't see where we're going to have time. Those are a pretty big and broad issue that I don't anticipate the availability of committee time. Representative Beard does have some energy bills, and if you have some, Representative Hilty, if you'd work with Ms. Rudolph on ones. We do anticipate as soon as next week, potentially. When we do that, I think we'll have an all-day energy day, maybe all-day, two-day energy days, but there are some that we have to give that area of the committee a priority. Representative Hilty?
That's fine. Thank you, Mr.
Chair. Thank you. Members, meeting's adjourned.